So let me introduce our next speaker. It's Dr. David Fredericks. So David's a professor of medicine in the Division of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the University of Washington, Seattle. He's also a member of the Vaccine and Infectious Diseases program at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center. He did his medical school training at Case Western. He went on to do his internal medicine training at UCSF, followed by an infectious disease fellowship at Stanford. And his research, he basically uses molecular methods and in vitro cultivation techniques to study how the human microbiota, particularly in the genital mucosa, affects human health, such as sexually transmitted infections. And so that's really going to be the focus of his talk today. He's going to talk to us about the molecular tools for studying human microbial communities, implications for STD research and diagnostics. Please give him a warm welcome.
Thanks a lot to Bill and Ellen for the invitation to speak and for the opportunity to reflect on our fellow travelers in the human body, our microbiota, and how they influence sexually transmitted infections and STI syndromes. The advent of molecular sequence-based methods in molecular microbiology has led to rapid advances in our understanding of the human microbiota. Surveys of different human body sites has revealed that each site has a distinct microbiota. For instance, the microbiota found in the human gut is hugely different than what you find in the human vagina. Interestingly, the microbiota in the human vagina is the least diverse of any mucosal site. But even if you look on the human skin, for instance, the microbiota in the auricular crease is different than the microbiota that you find in the antecubital fossa. The key point here is that each human body site has a different microbiota. Second point is that different humans have different microbiotas at each of these body sites. So this is some data from the American Gut Project. It's a citizen science initiative where people sent in thousands of samples for analysis of microbiome profiling. And what this shows is that, for instance, if you look at the fecal microbiota, there are some individuals that have a very high relative abundance of the Firmicutes, others that have very low abundance of the Firmicutes and high abundance of the Bacteroidetes or the proteobacteria. In fact, there is a gradation of microbiome profiles across humans at each body site. This has led to the suggestion that each person may have their own personal microbiome, as reflected in the diversity in each of these body sites. The implication is that these different microbial communities may have different impacts on our susceptibility to develop disease or our ability to maintain health. So, why is the human microbiota important for sexually transmitted infections? First, the microbiota may provide colonization resistance against STI pathogens. And the classic example is lactobacillus species present in the human vagina, which make lactic acid. Lactic acid is a fantastic antimicrobial. In fact, it's not just pH that is mediating the effect of lactic acid. Hydrochloric acid and lactic acid are different. At the same pH, hydrochloric acid does not have the same antimicrobial effect as lactic acid. Conversely, some genital microbes, such as BV-associated bacteria, may facilitate acquisition with STIs, such as HIV, chlamydia, or trichomonas. Thirdly, bacterial vaginosis, a dysbiotic condition in the human vagina, may itself be an STI, although this is subject of ongoing debate. Fourthly, extragenital reservoirs may harbor STI pathogens, and local microbiota may influence this initial colonization or transmission of STI pathogens to another partner. And lastly, members of the indigenous microbiota may be pathobionts, or symbionts with pathogenic potential, and be sexually transmitted. So what's an example of a classic pathobiont? In the respiratory tract, this would be Streptococcus pneumoniae, or the pneumococcus. 5 to 10% of adults, 20 to 60% of children are colonized with the pneumococcus in their respiratory tract. yet only a small minority of colonized individuals come down with disease, pneumonia, meningitis, bacteremia, otitis media. And so we're very comfortable thinking of the pneumococcus as being mostly a colonizer and an occasional pathogen. We haven't applied the same framework in terms of understanding genital tract microbes and their role in contributing to inflammatory processes such as cervicitis and urethritis. And I'll talk a little bit about that in my presentation. So first, a little bit of background on bacterial vaginosis. The most common cause of vaginal discharge associated with both discharge and malodor in symptomatic women, although a large fraction of women with a BV-like microbiota are asymptomatic. The prevalence is high, with up to 29% of women in the United States affected when using Gram stain to assess for BV. The epidemiology resembles that of an STD, and the diagnosis of BV can be made using several methods. As Rupert mentioned, AMSL criteria is usually used in the clinic, where you look for a series of exam and basic laboratory findings. More commonly in research studies, Gram stain is used to look for different abundances of bacterial morphotypes. And then there are a series of other assays that can be used. And I refer you to Debate 3 Thursday at 4:40, where Caroline Mitchell and Jeannie Marazzo will delve into the various diagnostic modalities for the treatment for the diagnosis of BV. How do we treat BV? Well, various antibiotics, but metronidazole or clindamycin, which interestingly have this anti-anaerobe spectrum of activity. Now, BV is noxious to symptomatic women, but even more importantly, it's associated with numerous adverse health outcomes. And for the STI crowd, this includes pelvic inflammatory disease, cervicitis, infection with other STDs, including gonorrhea, chlamydia, trichomonas, HSV, and HPV. And even more importantly, it's associated, as Rupert mentioned, with HIV acquisition, with about a 1.6-fold increased risk in women and about a 3-fold increased risk in men whose partners have BV. Now, as Rupert mentioned, how does this happen? Well, it's possible that BV may compromise epithelial and mucosal surfaces. How would it do that? By forming a biofilm on that surface, causing ejection of epithelial cells, by releasing proteases and mucinases and collagenases, which may break down some of that epithelium, and also, as Rupert mentioned, by causing inflammation with recruitment of inflammatory cells, particularly activated CD4 cells, which would facilitate HIV infection. So, in summary, and in keeping with the theme of this conference, BV may increase the risk of HIV infection in women by transcending barriers of epithelial barriers and creating opportunities for persistent HIV infection. I don't think the conference organizers thought of that concept. But what's really fascinating to me is that BV in a woman can increase the risk of HIV transmission to men. And in this fascinating study published by Craig Cohen and colleagues in PLOS Medicine, what they showed was that there's a 3-fold increased risk of transmission of HIV to a male partner when a woman has BV. But even more interestingly, women who had an increase in Nugent score over the course of observation of the study, the risk of transmission of HIV to the male partner increased to a 7-fold increase. So it's not just a BV, but it's actually the type of BV that seems to be associated with increased risk. We don't know the exact mechanism, how BV is acting at a distant site to increase risk of HIV transmission, but this deserves much further investigation. Now, what are the methods that we use to characterize microbial communities in microbiome research? There are several that are commonly used, and I'll go into 4 of them right now. The first is broad-range 16S ribosomal RNA gene PCR with high-throughput sequencing. This provides a molecular census of the bacteria that are present, and if you target a different gene, such as the 18S ribosomal RNA gene, you can look at eukaryotes, including fungi, that are present in the community. This is agnostic to membership. The output is relative abundance of sequence reads in a sample. It does not measure concentrations. So what do I mean? The way to think about this is that it's like you have a hat with a certain number of colored balls in it. and you reach into the hat and you pull out the balls and you look at it. That's a sequence read. And we know by reaching into that hat and pulling out those balls, for instance, that there may be three times as many green balls as yellow balls in that hat. But we don't actually know how many balls are in the hat. And if you do broad-range PCR with high-throughput sequencing on hat A and hat B, you have the exact same relative abundance of sequence reads. But there are twice as many balls in hat B as in hat A. So how do we get a better idea of concentrations of bacteria? Here we turn to a different technique, and this is real-time quantitative PCR, where what we do is we add known amounts of bacterial DNA to create a standard curve, and then add in our unknown sample to query how much bacterial DNA is present in that sample. This is directed, not agnostic. You need to know what you're seeking. And it's not feasible to develop assays for every bacterium in a community. It is incredibly laborious. Frequently, we use these techniques together, broad-range PCR to get an idea agnostically of who's there in the community, and quantitative PCR to say what's happening to levels of those bacteria, particularly over time. Another approach that's used for analyzing microbial communities is metagenomic sequencing. So here, instead of amplifying a particular gene from that community using PCR, you take the entire collection of nucleic acid from that community, extract it, and then subject it to high-throughput sequencing. This means that there is no bias from PCR because PCR is not being done. It is agnostic to membership, and it can detect viruses. Broad-range PCR of the 16S or 18S ribosomal RNA gene doesn't detect viruses because viruses don't have any conserved sequences. We can't do consensus sequence PCR. This approach can detect any pathogen because every pathogen contains nucleic acid sequences. The output is gene content, which informs both function and microbial membership. The problem with this technique is it is less sensitive for rare species that may be present in the community, and it depends on having a robust reference database for taxonomic assignment of species. Another alternative approach for microbial community analysis is to use fluorescence in situ hybridization, where we take a fluorescently labeled nucleic acid probe, hybridize it to a sample, and look for binding of that probe to a microbe using fluorescence microscopy. This is quantitative, and it provides information on localization of the microbe in the sample. However, it does require information about the specific microbe that you're seeking. This is an example of us using fluorescence in situ hybridization on a vaginal biopsy from a woman with bacterial vaginosis, where you can see in yellow bacteria that are taking up probes for Gardnerella vaginalis, showing the intense biofilm that's formed in this woman with bacterial vaginosis. Now, how do we apply these techniques? Well, let me give you some examples. And this is an example where we applied broad-range 16S ribosomal RNA gene PCR with high-throughput sequencing to women that were attending our STD clinic in Seattle, Washington. Here we looked at 220 women at one time point by broad-range PCR. On the right, what you see is the relative abundance of bacterial sequence reads with each horizontal bar reflecting a single subject. In the middle, you see ribbons reflecting BV status with AMSL and Nugent criteria, with BV being red and no BV being green. And then the tree on the left reflects hierarchical clustering, where each sample is grouped according to similarity of the bacterial community profile. And what you can see is that the hierarchical clustering algorithm groups these into two basic groups, this group here and this group here. This group is women who don't have bacterial vaginosis. And these women are dominated by Lactobacillus species, particularly Lactobacillus crispatus in red, Lactobacillus innes in orange, and Lactobacillus jensenii in yellow. In contrast, this group, women with bacterial vaginosis, have incredibly heterogeneous vaginal bacterial communities. There are some women who are dominated by Prevotella species, others by a Clostridiales order bacterium that we call BV-associated bacterium 1, which no one has yet cultivated. and others by, in green, Leptotrichia and Sneathia species. And then other women with BV have a more even mixture of Megaspira, Leptotrichia, Gardnerella, Adipobium vaginae, BV-associated bacterium 1, 2, and 3. The key point here is that bacterial vaginosis is not a single microbiological entity. There are a diversity of microbial communities in women with BV. Another approach that we have applied in our studies is a quantitative PCR. And here we use this technique to follow concentrations of bacteria over time. This is a single subject who had bacterial vaginosis at time zero and then had several relapses of bacterial vaginosis after antibiotic therapy. And here at the initial time point, she had very high concentrations of Adipobium vaginae and Megaspira and Leptotrichia and Sneathia. Was given metronidazole, had a rapid decline in concentrations of all of these BV-associated bacteria. Note that Lactobacillus innards, which started off at moderate levels, increased under metronidazole therapy. But then what happens is she comes back on three different occasions with recurrence of her bacterial vaginosis. And with each of these recurrences, she has a resurgence in concentrations of these BV-associated bacteria. The other key point, though, is that when she does recur, it's not necessarily with exactly the same bacteria. Here, for instance, with this first recurrence, she has high concentrations of Mobile Unca species, which weren't with the original, weren't common with the original episode, and were minority species with the other episodes. Several of these bacteria that we have detected are useful diagnostic indicators of bacterial vaginosis, but I just want to focus on one of these bacteria for the moment, and that is in, I think, pink, Magiae bacillus indolicus, a bacterium that we initially called BV-associated bacterium 3. This bacterium is found in about 40% of our STD clinic patients with bacterial vaginosis, but only 3% of patients without bacterial vaginosis, showing the high specificity of this bacterium for bacterial vaginosis. Now, cervicitis is a common STI syndrome, but a very large fraction of cervicitis cases lack a defined etiology, such as with gonorrhea or chlamydia. And indeed, numerous studies from several different continents have documented the high rate of unexplained or idiopathic cervicitis. For instance, Jeannie Marazzo's study, published in JID in 2006, looked at 424 US women with BV. 15% had cervicitis, and 87% of those were idiopathic. In a study from Peru, 92% were unexplained or idiopathic. In an Australian study, again, 82% of cervicitis cases unexplained. So we asked the question whether some members of the vaginal microbiota might be acting as pathobionts and capable of contributing to cervical inflammation. To investigate this question, we did a study of 14 subjects who developed cervicitis in our STD clinic and then compared them to 42 controls without cervicitis. And what we found using broad-range PCR with high-throughput sequencing was that there was one bacterium that was associated with cervicitis in these cases. And that was the bacterium Magiae bacillus indolicus. We then applied quantitative PCR assays to these samples and indeed found that Magiae bacillus indolicus, using a more sensitive quantitative PCR assay, was found in 43% of the cases and only 12% of the controls, a difference which was statistically significant. Interestingly, Lactobacillus jensenii, one of those key healthy vaginal lactobacilli, was associated with protection from cervicitis. This was a univariate analysis. Now looking at multivariate analysis of multiple additional factors that could be contributing to cervicitis, again, we still find that vaginal detection of Magiae bacillus indolicus is associated with a 1.63-fold odds ratio for cervicitis, and this is statistically significant. Now, when we tried to replicate these findings by applying this to a cohort of women in Kenya, a group of women studied by Scott McClelland in Mombasa, we could not validate these findings. And we asked the question, what is the difference between our subjects in Seattle and these women in Mombasa? And it turns out that cervicitis was being defined differently in these two different cohorts. And in the Mombasa cohort, they were not using cervical friability as one of the indicators of cervicitis. So that prompted us to go back to our Seattle cohort and examine what was the driver of the diagnosis of cervicitis in our patients. And what we found, actually, is that McGee bacillus indolicus is associated much more with cervical friability, with an odds ratio of 8 compared to mucopus, or the presence of polys in the cervix, with an odds ratio of 2.5, which was not statistically significant. So we think that McGee bacillus indolicus may be a pathobiont in the vagina that can contribute to cervicitis, but here, mostly cervical friability. This bacterium, McGee bacillus indolicus, was first cultivated in the laboratory of Sharon Hillier at McGee Women's Research Institute. In my lab, we have also cultivated this bacterium using quantitative PCR and addition of various metabolites to try and optimize the growth of this bacterium. And here you can see an initial attempt to isolate this bacterium in culture, where it's in with other bacteria, and we successfully isolated this now in pure culture, and these are the chaining rods of McGee bacillus indolicus. Two key things that I want you to remember about this bacterium. First is that this organism is susceptible to metronidazole, and secondly, that it produces the compound indole. Now, has anyone ever attempted to treat cervicitis with metronidazole? The answer is yes. In a very prescient study by Jane Schwepke and Heidi Weiss, they performed a randomized controlled trial of adding Metrogel to ofloxacin and doxycycline for the treatment of cervicitis in women with bacterial vaginosis. And what they showed in this study is that women with cervicitis and BV who were treated with metronidazole had an 89% resolution rate with the three drug combination. Those women that got placebo instead of metronidazole only had a 62% resolution of their cervicitis. So this study provides additional support for the concept that some anaerobic or BV-associated bacteria may contribute to cervicitis. Now, it's possible that BV-associated bacteria may function as pathobionts, but do they act as facilitators of infection for known sexually transmitted infections such as chlamydia? There are numerous cross-sectional studies that have demonstrated association, for instance, between bacterial vaginosis and chlamydia infection. But we don't know whether that's just reflecting shared risks or shared behaviors, or whether chlamydia is driving BV or BV is driving chlamydia, or whether it's a bidirectional interaction. So how would we sort this out? Well, we could sort this out in studies where you treat bacterial vaginosis and then look at the impact on incident infection with Chlamydia trachomatis. And there are a couple studies, including one by Jane Schwepke and one by Scott McClellan and Jen Balkus, that have demonstrated that metronidazole gel treatment has an impact in reducing rates of Chlamydia trachomatis infection. It was not quite statistically significant in Scott McClellan's study, where they used a composite endpoint, but in Jane's earlier study, there was a significant reduction in Chlamydia infections. Interestingly, in a follow-up study, Jane Schwepke has shown that treatment of asymptomatic BV with oral metronidazole did not result in a reduction in Chlamydia trachomatis infections. Why the heterogeneity? Is this a result of differences in delivery of the antibiotic, differences in the population under study, or differences in the bacterial communities? And by what mechanism would BV facilitate Chlamydia trachomatis infection? Well, we know that in the vagina, there are huge differences in bacterial metabolites that are present. And in fact, women with BV tend to have two different metabolite profiles, and women without BV tend to have two metabolite profiles. And we also know that some of these BV-associated bacteria, such as McGee bacillus indolicus, produce indole. So what happens with Chlamydia trachomatis infection? Well, when Chlamydia infects a cell, you get release of interferon gamma. Interferon gamma increases the activity of the IDO enzyme, which converts tryptophan to kynurenine. Chlamydia is auxotrophic for tryptophan. It requires tryptophan for growth. If tryptophan is not available, then chlamydia goes into a non-replicative state. But there's a way for chlamydia to get overcome this block, and it can do that by harvesting indole from its environment. So the thought is that BV-associated bacteria may produce indole. This indole is transported into the chlamydia cell, where it converts it into tryptophan and can overcome this blocking mechanism. So we think that this is one example of how BV-associated bacteria may contribute to the pathogenesis of chlamydia infection, but this needs to be confirmed in vivo. Now, the flip side of cervicitis in women is urethritis in men, and we find that there's a substantial number of men who also have unexplained urethritis. And we ask the question whether some novel general tract bacteria might contribute to cervicitis in men. So we did a study, again, at the STD clinic in Seattle, Washington, where we looked at 157 cases of cervicitis and compared it to 102 controls. And what we found using quantitative PCR techniques was that there was a particular bacterium, Leptotrichia and Sneathia species, associated with increased risk of urethritis, where Leptotrichia and Sneathia were found in 15% of cases and only 6% of controls. Again, suggesting that Leptotrichia and Sneathia may be behaving as pathobionts in men. Finally, as Rupert has highlighted, the vaginal microbiota may play a role in HIV transmission and infection. And there have been numerous studies linking a perturbed or dysbiotic vaginal microbiota to HIV acquisition risk, but we know very little about the precise microbes that may be playing a role in this process. So we did a study with Scott McClelland and colleagues looking at women in Africa who acquired HIV infection. And here we looked at 87 women who acquired HIV and compared these to 260 control women without HIV and used both broad-range PCR and species-specific quantitative PCR to characterize the microbiota in these women. And what you can see is that, this is the vaginal microbiota prior to acquiring their HIV. Cases had different microbiotas compared to controls. In fact, in cases, there was a substantial increase in microbial diversity in the cases compared to the controls. And using quantitative PCR, we showed that Megasphaera, Leptotrichia, Sneathia, and several other bacteria were associated with a substantial increased risk of acquiring HIV infection. This is exciting because it may mean that targeted eradication of these bacteria could lead to a reduction in risk, with the proviso that Rupert brought up, where it's also possible that short-term changes could actually increase risk based on inflammatory profiles provided. So in conclusion, molecular tools demonstrate the diversity of general tract microbes, including uncultivated species, and facilitate connections between bacterial communities and health and disease states. Different tools have different strengths and weaknesses, and you need to focus on what the underlying question is and then apply the correct tool. We've made associations between several of these novel general tract bacteria and STI syndromes, such as cervicitis and non-gonococcal urethritis, which require validation. The vaginal microbiota, particularly BV, has a huge impact on the concentrations of vaginal metabolites, and these metabolites themselves may influence risk of sexually transmitted infections. Finally, understanding how the general tract microbiota may influence HIV infection risk offers new and exciting avenues for HIV prevention strategies. I would just like to recognize the numerous people that have contributed to this work, including folks in my lab at the Fred Hutch Cancer Research Center and our computational biology group, as well as key collaborators such as Jeannie Marazzo at the University of Alabama, but particularly Lisa Manhart from the University of Washington for our NGU studies, as well as Caroline Mitchell from Mass General and Sharon Hillier from the McGee Women's Research Institute. Thank you for your attention.
All right, thank you, Dave, for that wonderful lecture. So we're going to take just perhaps a few questions here. If you have a question, please go to the microphone as this session is being recorded. And please also state where you're from. Kathy?
Good morning. Thank you so much to all of the presenters this morning. My name is Kathy Hsu. I'm a physician associated with BU Medical Center and the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. So, Dr. Fredericks, your question related to the respiratory tract pathogen and pneumococcus's behavior prompted me to think a little bit more about the host and the host response. In those women with undefined cervicitis, I'm curious to know what your thinking is in relation to whether or not the host may be playing a role or whether or not atopy may be playing a role.
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And indeed, you know, for using pneumococcus as an analogy, we don't know in many cases why, for instance, some child, for instance, will develop pneumococcal meningitis. And the presumption is there's something about that host that's driving that process. Or it could be, for instance, a change in epithelial barriers, such as a viral infection or something else that may lead to ingress of that. We haven't done any studies for our subjects, for instance, looking at the host side of the equation. Why is it? For instance, we showed that 40% of women with BV have McGee, Bacillus, and Dolichus, but 40% of women with BV don't have cervicitis. So what is it about those women that leads them to develop cervicitis? We have done no investigations in investigating that host side, but I think it's a very valuable exercise.
All right, next question.
Hi, my question is from Dr. Kaul. I'm Rakesh Bakshi from University of Alabama at Birmingham. So, Dr. Kaul, have you seen the changes in the macrophages environment in the FGT, female genital tract, considering the role of macrophages because they can also produce IP-10, plus Dr. Seth Burrows and Dr. Shahan has shown the macrophages actually affect the genetic bottleneck occurring in the FGT. So would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's a great question. One of the issues that we have, it's fantastic doing immunology when you have a foreskin, the work we've been doing recently, because it's quite a lot of tissue there. And, you know, you can do pretty much any immunology you want to do and still have enough left over to keep you going for 3 years. When we're doing these studies looking at the female genital tract, very often, especially if you're doing longitudinal studies, you collect a cytobrush, and there are very few cells on that cytobrush. And it means that we have in the past anyway been forced to narrow what it is that we look at. You got it that my shtick was a little bit T cells, and I think that it is true that in doing that we're not looking at a number of other things that are important. We have in some of the recent studies looking at bacterial vaginosis looked also at different dendritic cell populations. That work that Brett is putting out at the moment. And we don't see dramatic changes in those dendritic cell populations associated at least with changes in the flora, including macrophages. But I think that looking at that in more detail and potentially looking at neutrophils, because, again, neutrophils are such a prototypic cell in the context of inflammation, is work that we should be trying to build in if it's possible. And some of these omics techniques that allow us to look at many different things but not at individual cells may be useful in at least giving us some signal about what's important.
All right, let's take just one last question over here to keep it brief.
Thank you, Gabriela Paz-Bailey, CDC. I wanted to ask about the potential role of bacterial vaginosis on the lower effectiveness of PrEP among women, and could it sort of somehow affect metabolism of tenofovir?
Absolutely. And I think there's emerging data that's coming out that show that microbiota can influence metabolism of these compounds. So I think that that's absolutely a key story and something that we should be building into studies looking at PrEP, where we analyze the microbiota to see how this is affecting those levels. I think in terms of PrEP, it may be less important when you're talking about vaginal application of some of these compounds where you have extremely high levels where it's unlikely to be a sink into some of these bacteria or substantially metabolized by some of these bacteria. But certainly for oral PrEP where the levels might be lower, I think there could be a role for some of these bacteria extensively metabolizing some of these compounds.
I'm sorry, we're out of time for questions. So other questions, please come up to the speakers afterwards. Thank you so much, Rupert and David. Thanks, everyone. We're going to move on now to the Jack Spencer Award presentation.
Thank you very much. Okay, good morning, everyone. My name is Janice Norwood, and I'm the program management official for the Division of STD Prevention for the Centers for Disease Control. And it is my distinct honor to actually present this 2016 Jack Spencer Award. First, I'd like to start off by thanking our selection committee for the time they took to help us to make the selection this year, as well as the recommendations that they provided to make things even better. I also would like to thank the nominators for taking the time to nominate their colleagues. Please keep those nominations coming. So the Jack Spencer Award was established in 1999 to recognize excellence, commitment, leadership in the evidence, in the development, implementation, and support of science-based STD prevention program services. As our collective discipline continues to evolve, especially in the era of diminishing resources, our approaches to addressing challenges must be scientific, evidence-based, innovative, flexible, and adaptable to real-world situations. Therefore, the Spencer Award was established to highlight extraordinary efforts for exemplary colleagues. Jack Spencer was our first recipient who was recognized for 30 years of continuous, relentless pursuit of excellence, efficiencies in providing STD prevention services. So with that being said, this year's awardee, in its own right, is exceptional. He is a thought leader, innovator, who is never afraid to go against the grain. He has demonstrated time and time again a commitment to effective science-based programs, continuous innovation, profound commitment to helping people. His accomplishments are many, but I just want to give you a few, but not limited to. So currently, a health science clinical professor of medicine within the Division of Infectious Disease Global Health at the David Gavin School of Medicine at the University of California, Los Angeles. He has over 20 years of experience in STD prevention, in which he started in 1995 as an EIS officer at CDC. He served as the Deputy Health Officer and Director of the STD Prevention and Control Services at the San Francisco Department of Health in 1998. He is known and was known in that position as bringing extraordinary energy to the STD program by bringing together health departments, academic researchers, and physicians and community groups to tackle new and emerging issues for both STD and HIV epidemic. While with the San Francisco Department of Health, he was instrumental in establishing the St. James Infirmary, a groundbreaking leader in the provision of sexual health care for sex workers. Under his leadership in San Francisco, he developed and implemented the immensely popular and effective Health Penis campaign, which was highlighted in global media, including The Daily Show. Always ahead of the curve, he led efforts in San Francisco to provide anonymous partner notification through InSpot, and provide STD screening through online portal was one of the first to describe an outbreak of syphilis among men meeting partners online, and we're talking about the AOL chat rooms. That's a long time ago. While in San Francisco, he served on national and international groups, including WHO Congenital Syphilis Elimination Initiative and the National Coalition of STD Directors. Over a decade in San Francisco, with his wife and three children in tow, he relocated across the globe to take the position of branch chief, the HIV and TB division of Global HIV/AIDS in South Africa. While in South Africa, he led efforts to establish and approve evidence-based approaches to the provision and HIV of TB care in a setting with tremendous need. Upon his return to the U.S., he established himself as a global researcher with great depth and reach. His current research and practice is focused on new STD diagnostics, including drug-resistant Neisseria gonorrhea. He identified molecular marker for the point mutation showing resistance in fluoquinolone, and now all tests for NG are run using tests within 24 hours. He has established international projects with collaborators in Peru, Haiti, South Africa, and his new home in Los Angeles. While a tremendous researcher and clinician, he often finds time and best known for his commitment to training and mentorship. He has worked and developed scores of medical students, fellows, EIS officers, interns, undergraduates, and public health students. Many of you in the field of STD prevention have probably come across his path and found it to be a pleasure working with him and perhaps one of his trainees, that is. So as I mentioned, this is just a few but not limited to his accomplishments. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce, it is my pleasure, Dr. Jeffrey Klausner, 2016 recipient of the Jack Spencer Award.
All right, well, I want to thank my peers and colleagues who nominated me for this award and the committee for making the selection. Over the years, I've learned a lot from tremendous mentors, from Jonathan Mann of the Global Program on AIDS when I was in Kinshasa, Zaire, and then really my first mentor in the introduction of the world of STDs, Gail Bullen, when I was an EIS officer in 1995. So in the typical Gail fashion, she whirled into the EIS conference on the Saturday morning, right after the entire week of the whole process of selection. And she said, well, I'm only here for 5 minutes, and I only have a little bit of time to really see people, but I see you on the list, and you look fantastic, and if you want to come to San Francisco, the job is yours. And I was like, okay, well, I think I'll take that chance. I call my wife, Tammy, and I said, I think we're going to San Francisco. And from then, it's been a fantastic opportunity. The San Francisco Department of Public Health, under the leadership of Mitch Katz, was a phenomenal place to work in the late 1990s and 2000s. Had great mentorship there, and you know, it really was able to be successful because of the community there and the interest in really addressing STDs. And what I've key factors is to understand the science, advance the science, but also be an advocate, and also have a passion and a sense of mission for what you're doing. And to really be effective, if you could focus on the science, learn the science well, be an advocate, and then have that drive to make a difference, the field of STDs provides tremendous opportunity for that. And then, of course, I'd like to thank my wife, Tammy, who's been with me for over 20 years now, and has been a steadfast advocate as we've moved around the world from Boston to Seattle to San Francisco to South Africa to Los Angeles. She's always been there, supportive behind me, and some crazy ideas, some which have worked and some which may have not worked as well. But, you know, really it's a real testimony to people's faith and innovation and passion for STDs. So thank you very much.